Welcome to the Production First Mindset, a podcast where we discuss the world of building code from the lab all the way to production. We explore the tactics, methodologies, and metrics used to drive real customer value by the engineering leaders actually doing it. I'm your host, Liran Chemovich, CTO and co-founder of Rookout. Today, we are hosting Tyler Jewell of Dell Technologies Capital. Tyler has been an operator and investor in developer-related businesses for over 30 years. He was the CEO of three companies, including Code Envy, which he founded and sold to Red Hat. As an investor, he has invested as an angel and VC, and is currently focusing on developer, data, infrastructure, and metaverse investments. Thank you for joining us, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
So, Tyler, what can you tell us about yourself?
Oh, well, you know, I started off my career in computer science like a lot of people in our industry. I had always been fascinated with software engineering and had hoped to become a great engineer one day, and promptly figured out after university that I wasn't a very good engineer and that I enjoyed talking about products and shaping products a lot more than actually building those products. And that led to a pretty long career in and around product management. I had just wonderful experiences doing product-related roles at BEA, which was eventually acquired by Oracle, Red Hat, MySQL, and Quest Software. And Quest Software was like this billion-dollar revenue company that had 150 products. It was like a mutual fund of systems management products that, you know, spanned this whole gamut range. It was a really wonderful place to be because you got to work on dozens of products at the same time, which just expanded your whole mind. And, you know, and along the way, got to do mergers and acquisitions work, corporate investing. And that's really the precursor to studying markets, the evolution of markets, understanding the innovation cycle within those markets. And that's just a hop, skip, and a jump away from starting your own company, being an innovator, building a team, establishing a market footprint, and then going through the cycle of gaining share in that marketplace and establishing some sort of path to an exit. And so I've been fortunate enough to do that a couple of times along the way, and while doing that, expanding my investment horizon as well. So I've had a pretty blended exposure to a wide range of things, and it's been a lot of fun.
Sounds promising. Sounds impressive. Now, over the past few years, you've been mostly focusing on investing, and you've kind of been focusing especially on what you like to call the developer landscape, and I've seen you've published quite a bit about that. Can you share us what, in your mind, is the developer landscape?
So, early in my career, and, this was in the 90s, there were a very small number of developer tools, and the businesses around them were pretty concentrated. And technologists who showed interest in and around developer tools were largely dismissed. You know, the perspective was that there was no money to be had in developer tools, that the money was elsewhere, that the commercial prospects were dim, that they were difficult to build because developers were very finicky, had a tendency to roll their own. And as a result, these were not going to be good businesses. And that had always stuck with me, that there was this pervasive belief that developers were not an important class of influencer, buyer, and user. They were always kind of a resource that should be managed as opposed to a talent pool that should be nurtured. And, that stuck with me, over the decades as I was working through my product career. And when I got a chance to do some early M&A and investing, it was in these areas of developer influence and developer middleware. It was areas where I had particular domain knowledge. And so I could have a good inference and guess, if you will, or thesis on what was going to be a winner and what was going to be a loser in that space. And in order to do that early work, I just started collecting a database of companies that I had come across or commercial products, and started tracking, how they were doing, what their, business prospects were, what was the product's capability. And I developed that database over a decade. And when I joined Dell to do investing full time, I'd looked at the database and it was pretty substantial at this point. And I'd realized that there still was very limited writing and, you know, authorship, if you will, on people defining all these tools and capabilities. And so we took it to heart and we decided to go through a path of publishing all this data and teasing out the lessons that we've been able to learn by looking at it from over a decade. And we ultimately defined the developer landscape as products that are sold directly to, purchase influenced by, or consumed by developers, right? So if it's one of those three things, you know, it would fit into this category. And we excluded open source technologies. We were looking at commercial companies, companies who had an intended goal of, if you will, profiting in and around the developer ecosystem. And it turned out that if it's not just consumed by developers, but they are involved with the purchase or they influence the purchase of it, it turns out to be a pretty big ecosystem because there are very few things today that are not driven in some way, shape, or form by a developer adoption. And so we went about taking all the companies that we had, and that first version had about, I think, 650 or 700 companies in it. And we just organized it into a logical way that reflects how these businesses compete with each other and the categories that they are. And that turned into four major categories. And then there was another 17 segments within those categories. And, you know, what we did is we forcibly took all the companies that we had. We made sure that we were confident in their revenue and that it wasn't an exaggerated revenue number and what their growth rates were. And then we forced that each company or each product at a company had one predominant category that it fit into. You know, so something like a GitLab that does all sorts of different things, its predominant value proposition was version control. And so we took that GitLab product and put it in the version control category and not in, say, application security or whatnot. And so we just kind of created really tight guardrails, really strict criteria, held to that, and then updated all the data that we've got and decided to publish it. And we published the database, so the list of all the companies, the categories, and the segments that they were in. We didn't publish the revenues because some of that information could have been secret and, you know, some of it might have been just extrapolation on our part. But we do have a very high confidence level in all the revenue numbers that were targeted for each product there. And so it actually created this nice picture of the total commercial impact that developers have had and continue to have.
Now, we're recording this just a few weeks before you'll be sharing this year's report. And I was kind of hoping you could share with us some tidbits about what are some of the interesting highlights you have coming up.
Well, I think that there's a few things that are pretty wonderful about what's happened in this year's report. So the first is that the database has expanded to just over 1,000 unique companies and 1,200 products in it. It grew by a tremendous amount over the first version in just that year period. And that came from people who were seeing the landscape and wanted to get themselves added to it. It came from just a lot of new companies that have emerged. It came from tracking new investments and the announcements of new investments. Oftentimes, seed investments indicate the emergence of a new company that's there. And on top of that, very, very, very few bankruptcies. You know, going back through and checking to see, you know, did companies get acqui-hired? Did they go bankrupt? Very few on that. So almost everything that was a product that was a going concern in the previous year is still one a year later. And as a result, and driven predominantly by COVID with this now rapid acceleration for digital transformation, the overall developer landscape in the past 12 months grew faster than it did in the previous 12 months. And so I think in the first version of the landscape, we had said that the total revenues across all these companies was $40 billion. That's a very large number. It had grown, I think, 19% from the previous year. And growing 19% at that level, that's a lot of new revenue, you know, in a single year. And $40 billion, that is nothing to sneeze at. These are not hypothetical numbers. This is the aggregation of every product and what they're plausibly generating as revenue. And for this year, the market grew 22%. So it actually grew $9 billion. So if it grew about $7 billion in the previous year, it grew $9 billion to $49 billion $1 billion over the past 12 months. And that's just remarkable, right? So we went from a market that's been, you know, kind of, you know, doing okay. And, you know, it grew at an even faster rate, during the COVID period at an already large number. And I think that there's this wonderful quote from like the Microsoft CFO in 2001 or 2002, like 20 years ago. And he was getting in his earnings call, you know, they were giving him some static about the growth rate of Microsoft. And he just made this sort of comment about, you know what the hardest part about growing, you know, I think it was a $40 billion company, because which is what they were at the time, is that you first have to start by making $40 billion, you know, which is no hard, easy thing to do. And then you can focus on the growth. So going from $40 to $49 billion in a single year, it's a remarkable bottom line number on that.
And that's huge. And you've investigated so many categories, so many segments. Where do you see the customers? Where do you see the developers putting the money? Which categories are making the most out of those $49 billion?
Well, you know, the category that makes the most money is the one that's the oldest, and it's application servers. And so application servers is, you know, roughly a quarter of the whole thing at $13 billion. It's pretty flat. It's only growing like 4%, but a huge chunk of those application servers are legacy transaction monitors, very old school message brokers, runtime supporting, you know, legacy systems. These things, which we don't really talk much about or see much, they're out there and they're generating, you know, $8 to $9 billion in renewal income every year because organizations depend upon these systems and they pay the support fees for them. So that in terms of the most profitable and the largest, that's the one. Now, what's particularly compelling is the second largest category is also the fastest growing category.
Wow.
And so that's substantial. And that's API as a product. So a revenue generating API. So if we took Twilio as the, you know, preeminent example, there are now close to 250 companies whose entire business model is, we have built an API, we're advertising the API, we're going to monetize the API, and those companies collectively are generating over $10 billion of revenue and grew 63% last year.
Wow, that's huge.
63%, it's huge growth on, you know, and so I think that's a reflection of, if we have not seen a fundamental shift in the flow of money from, you know, paper transactions to API-based transactions, you know, if you haven't been convinced previously, these numbers have to convince you that digital API forms transacting business are the norm now.
Yeah, that's huge, because we're digitizing stuff, developers are trying to automate stuff, and you need APIs. You can't keep sending out letters and whatnot to do stuff in a manual manner.
Yeah, I mean, look at the growth of UiPath. You know, I mean, this RPA and bot automation was something I never thought would be a substantial market. But here is now a multi-billion dollar market, tens of billions of dollars of market value created around the concept of, you know, trying to create intelligent bots that automate manual tasks that you do on your computer. And I just never thought that there was that much repetitive manual things that people do that you could, you know, be willing to pay this much for these bots. But clearly there is, right? And so, and if people are spending that much to automate manual things like clicking through a spreadsheet or, you know, checking in on an email, imagine what they can automate if everything had an API against it. Because an API is structured, it's well organized, you know, it's discoverable. There's all these sorts of things that come with it. So the level of automation is just going to be 100 times higher, you know, as the world gets blanketed with APIs. And I think that the success of UiPath is just the precursor to what, you know, the overall success will be if everything's with an API. And that's why you see like the low code and no code market, it's at just under $3 billion. You know, low code is really a reflection of your ability to automate APIs that you're calling into. There you go.
I mean, that's pretty impressive. Going beyond APIs, going beyond automation, what other exciting trends are you seeing in the developer ecosystem?
There's a few that are worth, you know, talking about. So there's a couple of areas that are starting to go through consolidation. And, you know, I need to do some more writing about it, but I've been tracking this world for about 20 years. And if you're a student of history and go back and look at it from the previous 20 years over a 40-year horizon, the developer landscape goes through these mega waves after about 15 years. And it goes through a fragmentation cycle, a large fragmentation cycle, and then through a large consolidation cycle. And what ends up happening is that there's usually some sort of major paradigm shift that alters how people view applications should be constructed. And as a result, the entire tool chain has to be reinvented. And so the last cycle that happened was in 2005 with the introduction of Git. And Git was really the introduction of the idea that we were going to have distributed collaborative teams constructing software with decentralized version control as opposed to a centralized version control system. And so it just changed the behavior profiles and dynamics of how everybody would interact with each other. And so the entire tool chain had to be reinvented, not just version control, but CI, CD, configuration management, application security. It's just kind of all happens in these point ways. But after a while, once the concepts are baked in to all these different point products, it becomes too complicated for organizations to maintain their agility while embracing all these different point solutions. And so the market goes through a consolidation phase where you start to see mega platforms emerge that, consolidate all these things into a unified workflow that really provides higher forms of productivity. And you were starting to see that with the way that the Slack platform is evolving, the way that the Atlassian platform has evolved, GitHub and GitLab, they're definitely striving to be, end-to-end comprehensive solutions. And then they start to muscle out and push out the innovators in those point arenas until that wave will typically last 5 to 10 years. We're in the earliest stages of that mega wave, and we're starting to see this sort of consolidation happen in a number of places. There's consolidation that's been happening on the progressive delivery market, which is really the combination of CI/CD, experimentation, feature flags, and science-based analysis, product-led growth through science-based analysis. And so these things were, each of those components had companies and products that were individual and successful. And what you're really starting to see is the rationalization of all those things and all those vendors competing with one another by expanding their product portfolios to have it all integrated together so that there's kind of one form of intelligent progressive delivery that your organization can do. That's one mega trend on the consolidation. The second, kind of mega trend is that SRE as a named important influential profession is now, becoming commonplace. They've got a dedicated tool set. They've got well-defined and declared responsibilities. They are increasingly getting direct budget allocated. They have a rising level of importance based upon where they sit in the organization by, oftentimes reporting into senior executives in the product organization. And they've had, slightly diverging interests from those of the operations teams or the development teams. So SRE is a discipline for, the professionalism of, scaling a system and keeping it within your objectives and SLAs is now a defined category. And as a result, there's any number of startups that have emerged. And it turns out that the SRE and debugging as a category was the third fastest growing category in the new landscape. It grew 50% year over year to a $2.2 billion. So SRE as a category and the associated products are pretty remarkable on that. It's so remarkable that it's starting to take away from the observability space, and the observability market, which was historically logs, metrics, monitoring, now includes traces and advanced forms of software debugging, which is where, obviously Lightrun fits into the space. But there's just such an overwhelming amount of data that in the observability space, they're also trying to rationalize and consolidate down so that you can provide advanced forms of consolidated views across logs, traces, metrics, all in a single view. And you can get as detailed and specific in your analysis without impacting performance as you want. So there's just kind of this need to consolidate the data, get all of it, have intelligent forms of filtering, and then present the data in a way that's useful to the operations team, to the developer team, you know, if they want stack traces and memory footprint snapshots, or the SRE team who's focused on stability and scale on that. These are kind of the big things that are getting teased out right now and you see happening.
So how do you see observability kind of meeting those expectations? In the past, observability was mostly about ops. You just had ops, they wanted to make sure the system was up and everything was good. Now you have ops, you also have devs who are shifting left and care more about what's going on with their code in production. And you have the new rising SRE professions who care about a whole set of different items. So kind of have you have the same set of observability tools, but all of a sudden they have three different groups that are looking for different results using those same tools.
So the question there is,
where do you see observability tools going to meet those diverging requirements?
Okay. So it seems that with observability tools, there's a couple of drivers for how people are adopting them going forward. One is there's just an increasing amount of regulation and compliance that, you know, really dictate what can be collected, who has the ability to look at that data, where can it be stored. And those requirements are changing, you know, so rapidly that it's really influencing how observability vendors architect, structure their business, and which customers are going to, you know, go to which vendors at the end of the day. That's one potential driver. The second driver is that it's become quite costly to operate a lot of these observability tools, especially if you're collecting everything. So if you're going to have a logging system and collect all the logs, if you're going to have a metric system and collect all the metrics, at scale, it's becoming cost prohibitive. But I think a lot of customers are making sure that whatever solution they can put in place, they can turn it on, turn it off, have high degrees of filters associated with it. And then I think the third driver is that it's also quite difficult to have all these different forms, logs, metrics, and traces in disconnected ways. And there's really no need for that. And so I think people are striving towards having connective tissue across those things. They want their stack trace and their memory snapshots to be included as part of that. If you will, as a giant data warehouse of all your observability data, so that you can slice it and dice it however you see fit, as opposed to having it reduced by sampling, reduced by some, you know, aggregate calculation that might overlook the real issue, and instead, you know, treating it as a analytics warehouse so that the professional can do investigative work by slicing and dicing how they see fit to figure out what's really going on.
Essentially, everybody wants more control over the data, both for compliance reasons and for operational reasons. I know you're super excited about the metaverse and you've been keeping track of that over the past years. And I know in the past, the metaverse was just a sci-fi concept. So what does it mean today?
There's many different definitions of the metaverse. My own definition of the metaverse is that it is any place where people can have shared experiences with the physical and the digital world. And I think the classic, you know, definition of the metaverse, you know, maybe visualized in, you know, the Ready Player One movie, where you have this giant global network that is one shared, synchronous, consistent state that everybody's participating in simultaneously. You know, there's a lot of companies that are striving to deliver that, whether it's Microsoft with Minecraft, you know, Roblox, which is a really fun simulation environment, or even, you know, Facebook, you know, striving to, you know, to deliver their social media platforms as an extension of the metaverse. And on the flip side of that, you've got these industrial IoT companies, which are also providing forms of metaverses, which is they provide digital twins of physical environments that are there, you know, like a factory or maybe a medical facility where you can monitor things, and that it's easier to do simulations with the digital than it is to do it in the physical real world. The metaverse is all those concepts and everything in between. It's anything that brings people together in a shared way that blends the physical and the digital. And so even Zoom is an extension of the metaverse, because you can apply a filter to Zoom, or you can actually do a little bit of an overlay where you get some ears or maybe a mustache, you know, for fun or for joke. Well, that is an extension of the metaverse, because you're taking a physical person, they're getting a 2D representation, and then you're putting a digital overlay in real time that is adapting and moving as that person interacts with that system. So Zoom is an extension of the metaverse as well. And what we're going to see is we're probably going to see millions of metaverses crop up. People might have their own personal metaverse, right? They you know, walking down the street with their AirPods, you know, if you get augmented audio that is blending out, you know, background noise, but enhancing some other audio cue while you're either playing a game or talking to somebody, that's a form of the metaverse because you're augmenting the world around you to create an enhanced experience with either yourself or other people on the front. So we're going to have millions, if not potentially billions, of metaverses that are out there. There are some amazing and inherent technology challenges that we have to overcome in order to deliver upon these, because the most powerful metaverses are those when groups of people can come together and have a shared experience. Now, I've become particularly tired of Zoom. I think Zoom is very stressful on the senses, particularly over long periods of time, and you lose that human connection. But you know, we're not going to be far off from having systems that are, you know, visual and audio and actually tactile, where people can immerse themselves either for meetings or for groups of people in gameplay or collective family reunion. You pick whatever that is, and you won't have to add a lot of devices. It won't be these clunky, you know, VR glasses. It'll be something on your hand. It'll be something very kind of non-intrusive. But the real challenge there is that if the metaverse that you're going to participate in is not just audio, but it's actually visual as well, and you want that visual to be a three-dimensional visual, like through your monitor or whatever it is, what you're talking about is very high rendering, and then you have to have a synchronized state for the entire population that's participating in the same way. And that's a very difficult problem, because if the latency for that synchronized state is more than 50 milliseconds, then it starts to become an experience where people feel like it's not, it's disjointed at that point in time. And so it takes away from the experience that they've got. And if you're dealing with competitive gamers, right, where it's a large competitive game simultaneously, they demand about 25 to 30 milliseconds. Like, if they notice that the latency goes beyond that, it actually impacts their ability to have a competitive edge. In the most aggressive games that are delivering metaverses, you know, they're really only at 150 players in a simultaneous realm. They may give you the impression that there's 10,000 people, but they're breaking it down into lots of different subcomponents so that there's only really like 150 people within a simultaneous real synchronized state. And Roblox and some of the others are promising to be able to get that up to 1,000 people. There's all sorts of hacks and tricks that they've got to do in order to deliver upon that. They have to offload certain, you know, image rendering to the cloud, you know, render it once and then just send the updates down to everybody as opposed to everybody's separate machines doing the rendering. They also have to geolocate people, right? Because you can get lower latencies if you know that everybody's within a physical realm of each other, as opposed to, say, two people who are on the opposite side of the world. So there's all sorts of, you know, tricks and hacks that they do. And then there's other things that they can do, including they know who's the weakest latency link in that basket. And then they can downgrade everybody else's latency to match on that. So they can forcibly delay sending certain information over the wire so that everybody gets an equivalent experience at the end of the day. So there's all sorts of things on that front, which make it utterly fascinating there.
Now, I know we're all edging to get real VR games in the metaverse and spend all of our time gaming, but many of us are kind of wondering about enterprise software, about the business world. How will the metaverse affect the way we work and operate?
If you believe this idea that we're going to have millions, if not billions, of metaverses, and that people are going to, you know, crave this, because even subtle digital enhancements to your physical world improve your productivity or quality of life. If that's really going to be the case, if you already buy into that idea that everybody's going to be participating in the metaverse in some, you know, soft or hard way, then much the way that the world transitioned onto the web in the 90s and then transitioned into mobile over the past decade, right? As the world transitioned onto those mediums, businesses were compelled to put up a storefront in those locations, right? There was a massive migration of businesses to have a web presence. Then there was a massive migration of businesses to have a mobile experience. And that was really, you know, driving now, you know, now what's being driven is that, you know, businesses are looking to have a completely digitally native experience, a digital transformation experience. Well, guess what? If there's going to be billions of metaverses and people are actively spending their time in those environments, businesses will be forced and compelled to have an experience there. Initially, just as a branding and advertising and exposure mechanism, but fundamentally on the longer haul, it will be a fundamental place where businesses will go to meet people either for customer support or marketing or purchasing, you know, whatever that may be there. And if that's the case, when you start to think about the technology implications of the metaverse, the entire cloud stack, marketing tech stack, and advertising tech stack will fundamentally be different for businesses that want to have an experience in the metaverse than they do versus a mobile experience or a web experience. So the entire, you know, that's $250 billion worth of companies. That entire stack will have to be reimagined and re-envisioned in order to support businesses over there. Now, we're starting to see the, you know, early companies going into this space. Really creative avatars are a big thing right now. You know, people buying them, selling them, customizing them so they can put them into different metaverses. Those avatars can then be decorated with accessories or clothes or whatnot. So, you know, obviously all those brands are working to have the digital equivalents so that you can have, you know, your Nike shoes on your personal avatar in your metaverse. And I know that seems silly, but, you know, yesterday there was over $100 million spent trading cyberpunks, which are these tiny little 8-bit, you know, they might be 16, but I don't know, just little tiny avatars, you know, people are buying and selling these things. So, you know, there's real money being exchanged on a daily basis for digital goods and services. So given that that is custom digital services, it's not going to be far off before everything that you buy in the physical world will have a digital equivalent. You know, like if you go to Foot Locker and you buy a pair of shoes, why can't you also get the digital equivalent of that? And that it will simulate in the same way and that you can use it however you see fit. And you go, hey, that seems kind of silly and simplistic. But then, you know, if that happens to every physical object you have, including, say, like your home, suddenly now your home has a digital presence. You can do all kinds of interactions with that. You might be able to do a reconfiguration, a new design. You might do a simulation in a fire or a flood for insurance purposes, you know, and it goes and goes and goes. And so this is going to creep in very slowly, but it's going to be as big of a wave as mobile or web was for businesses at the end of the day.
Can't wait.
I don't think any of us can, but, you know, we'll see if I can get my mother to wear a pair of, you know, AV glasses one day. That we'll know that it's arrived if my mother ever puts them on.
Yeah. That's going to be interesting to see my mother put on those glasses.
It'll show up in really subtle ways. I mean, there's an number of wearables. You know, we'll be able to put digital technology inside your shirt. You know, like look at my logo here. That's a pretty thick logo. And so you can get long-lasting technology in there. And, you know, and that can give you an audio enhancement. It can give you a location beacon. It can give you vibration, right? So you can get tactile feel experience out of that. You know, the technology is getting pretty close. We're not far enough away we're not that far off where this stuff will be so seamless and embeddable in everything that you've got. We just have to really work on the audio visual, you know, the visual realization and the tactile experience to get it, to make it a little bit more realistic at a less bulky configuration. This was fun. I hope it's useful. I hope you'll be able to edit it.
It's super useful. So I'm just going to ask one final question, and then we can say goodbye and wrap this up.
Okay.
Tyler, it's been super interesting, but before we wrap this up, I would love to ask you one question. I ask all of my guests. So what's the single bug that you remember the most from your career?
Oh, Jesus. I got a B on a major project in my computer graphics class. And I was either a sophomore or a junior. I think it must have been as a sophomore. because I remember it, you know, and it was such a simple project. It was, there was an oval on the screen. You put random objects inside the oval, squares, rectangles, circle, whatever. And then you drag a ray and let it go. And then the ray would bounce around within the oval, but off of the objects that were inside. Had to be written in C. And for whatever reason, I had this project. It was implemented. It was working. And once every 5,000 or 6,000 times, the ray would just go right through one of the objects, right through the middle of it, as if it wasn't even there. And I did like a 36-hour, you know, coding session to try to fix this. My girlfriend at the time she spent the night in the computer lab with me. I don't know why she did that. I remember this very carefully. And I could never get it fixed. And it gave me a freaking beat. I was just so pissed off. Even to this day, I don't understand what happened with it. The teacher couldn't figure out what happened with it either. And sticks with me. I was really pissed about that.
Yeah, that's a great story. I'm guessing that's why you went into product in the end.
Yeah, I don't think I was a good debugger. You know, it could have been that the mathematics around graphics were just too complicated for me. Maybe I just was missing it. I'm sure it had something to do with floating point arithmetic or, you know, but the way C handled, you know, long integers or whatever it was. I'm sure that was probably the bottom line of it.
Yeah, too many standards for floating points, especially once you go down to C and the processor level.
Yeah, Java wasn't available at the time, you know, which probably would have made it a lot simpler. But it was all C programming at the time, so...
So Tyler, it's been great having you on the show. It's been a thrill talking about the metaverse and other cool trends. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. That was so nice to be here.
So that's a wrap on another episode of the Production First Mindset. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share this podcast. Let us know what you think of the show and reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Production First. Thanks again for joining us.